live from Lane County, Oregon. It's the Bo's Nose Show with your host, West Lane County Commissioner Jay Goldsevich. And now, here's Jay.
And good evening again from lovely downtown Elmira, Oregon, where it was a really nice day with just enough clouds floating around that it ought to be a real beautiful sunset here. So once again, this is the Bo's Nose Show. And if you want to get in on the act today, because it is a free-for-all day where we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about, you can give me a call at 646-721-9887. And just press 1 if you want to get in on the conversation, or you can just email me at any time, even when the show's not on, about what question or a topic you want me to talk about at talk@krbnradio.net. So lots of things going on in the news lately, but you can call about just about anything. You can call me about our conversation we had last week about smart meters if you were unable to make the radio show last week and you had something you wanted to get in and talk about. Even though I don't have my guests with me, I think I can deal with a few questions on that. Or we could talk about, the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, and how all these health providers are pulling out. And there was an article in the news today that health insurance premiums are going to go up for a lot of people in a double-digit range. Fortunately, though, Lane County government going self-insured last year is actually saving us about $2.1 million in insurance cost this coming budget cycle, which is helping us close our budget gap. And speaking of that budget, got released to the public on Tuesday, and our county administrator has got a really great 5-minute budget message that's available on YouTube, and I posted a link to it on my personal Facebook page. And I'll probably share that also out on a couple other pages here. But if you get a chance to listen to our new county administrator, fairly new county administrator, I don't know anyone that can talk about having to close a $6 million budget hole with as much optimism and enthusiasm as Steve manages to do. But I think it is a testament to our staff and all that we managed to innovate our way to about $4 million of closing that $6 million gap at the same time as being able to rearrange a few positions and priorities and expand some services in both prosecution of criminals and in supplying mental health treatment for folks that are involved in the criminal justice system. Because we have 60% of our jail inmates here in Lane County are diagnosed with a behavioral health issue. So we can talk about the budget, or we can talk about feeling the burn. Good old Bernie Sanders was in town today in Springfield, which is just a stone's throw or so here from beautiful downtown Elmira. And, the burn was out there doing his usual dance, promising free everything. Of course, he says, well, necessarily have to raise taxes to pay for all that stuff. And we can talk about Bernie a little bit. Saw some interesting Facebook pictures of some of the people that were gathering for the Bernie Fest today. I wonder if that's like Burning Man. When he comes to town and feel the burn and they're having kind of a festival atmosphere. Yeah, sort of like it. So we had our own Burning Man here in Springfield tonight, or I should say at lunchtime today. We can talk about that. We could talk about John Boehner. Did it help or harm Ted Cruz that he called him Lucifer and said that he's a miserable son of a bitch? I can say that on internet radio, can't I? I think I can. But, did that help Ted Cruz? Did it hurt Ted Cruz? Yeah, I don't know. John Boehner doesn't exactly have a lot of positives with a lot of Republicans right now, so I'm not so sure that hurt him. But yeah, there's just a few things out there in the world today, and we can get into whatever you want. It's kind of interesting. Eugene Weekly, our local progressive weekly news magazine, came out with their election endorsement issue, and surprise, they endorsed Lucy Vinnis for mayor of Eugene. We can talk a little bit about that. And what was interesting, they chose not to make any endorsements in the Republican primaries because they thought it would be, being disingenuous, because they wouldn't support any Republican in a general election race. So it was kind of interesting, but we could talk a little bit about the Eugene Weekly, or we can even talk about the Registered Guard. And, you know, I'm not so sure what's going on there, but there is an article about the Secretary of State's Republican primary today. And, you know, they chose to report how much money had been raised in just year 2016 between the two major candidates for that position on purpose, because it makes the local guy look bad, which is interesting. I don't know what the beef is between Commissioner Lycan and the Register Guard, but he raised over $100,000 in 2015 before Dennis Richardson ever declared to get in the race. But they seem to leave that out of the article, and they made it sound like there's this 10-to-1 fundraising difference between the two candidates when it's nowhere near that. Want to talk about journalistic ethics, professionalism a little bit. We can talk about both the Register Guard and Eugene Weekly. Had my own experiences with both of them. Some not so good, some not so good. But, it's terrible when, my dad was in media, worked for CBS News, and I have a lot of respect for good journalists. My dad was in radio back in the day when he used to write his own copy for the hourly news. He didn't have somebody writing it for him, and he was just a talking head that spoke it over the radio. He got up and went into the office at 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning, pulled stuff off the teletypes from overnight, assembled what he thought the top news stories were, put them in order, wrote up copy, and then had a 15-minute, basically, top-of-the-hour newscast, which was broken into segments so that various affiliates could bump out of it after 5 minutes or 10 minutes or do the whole 15-minute news show. That was, a day of much more honest journalism. Not to say that my dad wasn't a wildly liberal Democrat and occasionally chose to report stories that were more favorable to his side and less favorable to the other side more often than not, but he at least had an aspect where he really despised overt journalistic lack of ethics or having an agenda. It used to just drive him crazy. And, I see that sometimes in today's local media. I see it in the national media. And, I can just, see my dad, who was originally hired by Walter Cronkite, turning over in his grave with some of what goes on, what's considered journalism today, which really isn't. It's more propagandizing than anything. He at least had enough respect for the word journalism that he quite often did not let his personal political beliefs into the newsroom. And he just reported news straight up as it happened, and was basically reporting what happened rather than opining on what happened. So might give you a hint of how I ended up in politics after being an engineer. Kind of grew up around politics. Grew up around Washington, D.C. Interesting place to grow up. So, again, I'll remind folks, tonight's a free-for-all. And if you want to get in and steer the conversation to whatever topic you want to steer it to, you can just give me a call at 646-721-9887 and just press 1 to let us know that you want to get in on the conversation. That lets our call screener know you want to talk, and we'll get you in here. And if you want to email me, it's talk@krbnradio.net. Now, I want to remind folks, too, that if you want to listen to a past show, you can do that through iTunes, KRBN, or you can just go to the Google KRBN, and we're the top return on the search, and you can go to the website, and then all the shows are there also that you can just click on and play. There's some pretty interesting ones back there. Everywhere. I had a couple interviews with the sheriff. We've talked with folks that are in charge of local nonprofits. We've talked with police chiefs, and we've talked with somebody from an electric utility about smart meters last week. And I was kind of rather surprised I didn't get some call-ins on that show, because it certainly generated a lot of Facebook comments before the show ever went on the air, when I posted on Facebook that I was going to be talking about smart meters. So it's a kind of interesting thing that is going on with those. And, I don't believe a lot of the bad issues that both sides want to put up, whether it's the electromagnetic field causing cancer side of smart meters are bad, or it's the this is all a conspiracy to control your thermostat from a central control room, which is impossible unless you agree to have that done in your house. It's one of those things where I think there's a lot of myth out there as to what a smart meter really does and really can do and can't do, and just how much radio signal energy they put out compared to like your cell phone that you carry actually on your body. That was an interesting conversation last week with Lance Robertson, and you can listen to that whole show if you want, anytime you feel like, just by getting on the internet there. So I'd like to kind of bring my producer Robin in on the thing on this show. And by the way, that's where the RBN comes from in KRBN. So Robin, you want to get in on the conversation here?
Sure, Jay. And so much modesty on the KRBN thing. I wanted to make a quick comment as we're talking about smart meters and the fact that I don't think he addressed this last week when we talked about it, but if you're monitoring with a smart meter, then what to stop them to go, okay, during high peak hours, we're going to charge you more per kilowatt hour than we are going to at night, instead of like the flat rate per hour we have now.
Yeah, we actually did talk about that last week for a little while during the conversation towards the end of the hour. And at least at eWeb, they have set up a couple pilot programs where people can volunteer, and they're trying to see how that works and whether people are able to save money on their bill by having that, basically time of day charges. And, it is kind of the future of electrical power, because there is a really extreme cost of trying to generate for the peak hour. What people might not understand when they think about the electric grid is you need to be able to put the amount of energy into the grid that's coming out and match them pretty equally. If you put more energy in than it's being used at that time, you'll actually fry circuits and do other bad things. If you don't put in enough, voltage will drop and people will have damaged computers and everything else from low voltage issues. So you can either go over voltage or under voltage. So they're constantly in this balancing act of trying to get all the power sources. And this is from dams that have multiple turbines that they can open the floodgates at different, the valves at different settings to get higher, spins on the turbines and more power out of them, to how many boilers you have going at a coal plant, to how many windmills you actually have on the grid. What happens in the evenings that people don't understand is you know, there's a little bit of a peak in the morning. Everybody gets up, takes their showers, turns on the, you know, the appliances, turns the heat up in the house maybe. So there's this peak in the morning. It drops down during the middle of the day. Even though there's all those businesses using power, it doesn't drop down as far as it does, like, say, at 1 and 2 in the morning. But right about 5 o'clock, it skyrockets between 5 and 7 p.m. To the largest peak of the day. And it's a very steep incline, so they have to be able to turn on a lot of power right away. And what they're doing now, because they can't bring a boiler up to speed that fast or spin up a turbine at a hydro plant that fast, they run those turbines and stuff. They start them up hours before the peak and run them where they're not dumping juice into the grid, just basically with the drive in neutral to the generator, with the turbine spinning and using some kind of energy on the other end, like gas, coal, water, you know, whatever it is. And then as the need for that electricity spikes in the evening, they throw the clutch and start spinning the generators and put it down the grid. And that's hugely wasteful and hugely costly. And also means you have to build the capital for that peak moment when everybody has their lights on, cooking dinner, taking showers, got the heat up, television's blaring, whatever else is going on. And that's really an expensive thing for a utility to track. It doesn't cost them a lot to meet a base load for 24/7. You know, it's a predictable thing that, you know, whatever that minimum thing that happens at 2 o'clock in the morning, they can develop a power source that can run 24/7 at that base load fairly cheaply. It's those peaking sources that are so expensive. And that's also when buying power on the grid from another utility is the most expensive, too, because it's in such high demand. So there is a reason to have time of day metering in some ways, because it costs the power company more in time of day. And if we could get people to try and save money by using power, say, at lunchtime or waiting till past the peak hour to run that load of laundry overnight, maybe instead of during the peak hour, it would shave the need for maybe building additional peak power generation, which is the really costly part of the electrical grid. So what the smart meters can do is facilitate in the future metering by time of day, where the rates vary by time of day. And the control you have over that as a consumer, there is a fair amount of control over that. There's some that, you know, when you're not home, you're not home. And when you're home, you're going to turn your lights on start. But there is some discretionary use of power that could definitely be spread out more during the day. But there's a lot of other services that are already time of day usage that we don't even think about right now. I mean, I don't know about you, but I hate crowds. I mean, it's odd for somebody that's in politics, but I'm really not one that enjoys being in a large crowd. So when I go to the movies, I go on Sunday at 10 o'clock in the morning when I can pay the low ticket price and no one else is in the theater. And I usually wait till after the movie's been out several weeks before I'll go to it. You know, but, you know, if you go first week of a movie that's a blockbuster movie and you want to see it not only at 7 o'clock at night, but you want to see it on the IMAX screen in 3D, you're going to pay a lot more for that movie than I might pay at 10 o'clock in the morning after it's been in the theaters for a month or so and on a smaller screen without the 3D and IMAX. You know, it's, you know, when people want to see something, you know, if you want to see it, you know, during that peak time, and, you know, restaurants do it, you know. What's Blue Plate special and what's the early bird special and all that, you know, that they have, you know, Denny's or Sherry's and some of these restaurants, they all have some special that runs from 4 to the 5:30 or, you know, early dinner stuff. It's about getting people to come in the restaurant when it's not busy and their kitchen's not slammed, so they don't get as many people in there between 6 and 7:30 when the kitchen's crazy, the tables are all full, and they're, you know, that's why you pay more at that time of day. And it's typical of multiple business after multiple business, and we talked about that a little bit at the end of the show. But it's not in place yet, but it's something that could happen in the future.
Well, speaking of metering and stuff, do you want to touch a little bit on, this is more Oregon stuff, but on the proposed carbon tax?
Yeah, and I tell you, I haven't read the bill, but if it's like most carbon taxes and sets up carbon trading, it is a disaster waiting to happen for our economy. You know, based on a lot of what I believe is junk science to start with, but we won't get into a discussion of whether CO2 is the real issue in climate change and global warming or not. It's just when you start setting up taxing carbon, you're taxing energy. In fact, you know, you might as well equate carbon to energy whenever somebody starts talking about we need to limit CO2 or we need to control it, tax it, trade it, you know, credits and stuff like that. They're all talking about doing something with energy. And when you start doing something with energy, you're talking about some energy goes into everything we consume. There is nothing that doesn't require energy to produce, to transport, or to create. I don't even care if you're going to say a psychiatrist for his services, you still have energy involved in that because his office has got to be heated and lit and various other things. So when you talk about taxing energy, you're talking about taxing the entire economy. So a carbon tax is basically one of the most broad-based taxes you could do, yet it will be one of the most hidden taxes we could ever do. The consumer will not see how much of the increase in costs as, you know, he'll just say, oh, it's inflation, you know, some piece of inflation. They won't understand that's actually that's some carbon tax here in Oregon that's inflating your prices in Oregon. And the thing is, it's also going to get passed on through each step of the economic chain. So somebody, you know, pays to go out and fish for salmon, and he's buying fuel for his boat. He's paying a carbon tax on that fuel. He comes back in and he has to charge the price per pound to the canning and smokehouse that's buying the fish from him and is producing it for retail sale, more to make up for that tax on his fuel. And then that, you know, packaging, you know, person is going to pay more on his electrical bill and his, you know, whatever his boiler, his gas bill to run all his canning equipment, whatever else he's doing. And so he's going to add on to the cost of whatever he's buying the fish for, plus he's going to add on for his cost in the carbon tax. And it's going to get to the grocery store, and the grocery store is going to have paid more for that product to begin with that already has the fisherman's extra tax cost and the producer, the manufacturer's tax cost. And that retailer now is going to add his extra energy cost to it. And by the time it gets to the consumer, who's also going to be paying extra carbon tax costs for the gas that took him to get to Fred Meyer, is paying four levels of taxation, and it won't show up. He won't know he's paying it. It'll just be that salmon, that can of smoked salmon that he just bought at the grocery store, cost him 10% more than it did last year.
Well, there's one other point that you left out, is that let's say for, I don't know the exact amount of the price per gallon increase proposed, but let's just say it's 20 cents a gallon, which is probably nothing if you have a 10 or 20 gallon tank. But let's take a commercial vehicle which has 200 gallons at 20 cents a gallon. That adds up pretty quick.
It certainly does. And, you know, and that's the cost, you know, I probably forgot another level of taxation in there. When that fish, you know, those cans of smoked salmon are shipped from the manufacturer to Fred Meyer, it's an 18-wheeler that hauls it from some trucking company. You know? So there's another level of where that tax would get tagged on to that product. And if you were to go to the consumers in Oregon today and say, we want to throw a 10% sales tax on everything you buy, no exceptions, services, pharmaceutical products, food, you know, cars, you name it. Everything sold in Oregon is going to get this 10% hidden tax. You know, if it was an overt tax like that, there would be a revolt. There would be recalls from the governor on down to the lowliest representative in Salem, you know, if you proposed a 10% sales tax in Oregon on everything. But you do it as a carbon tax, and it's hidden. It's, you know, almost as bad as this initiative petition 28 that's being circulated now, where the unions are trying to get a gross receipts tax on large businesses that do business in Oregon. It's a similar sort of thing where it doesn't matter whether you make a profit or not. They're going to charge a tax basically on your total business activity in Oregon, you know, your total receipts in Oregon. And, you know, that wouldn't, you know, if you're a wholesaler, if you're an original producer, or if you're an end retailer, you're, you know, if you're over a certain amount, dollar amount, they're going to charge this tax on it, and it's going to be hidden. It's going to increase the prices of the products, and it won't be there. And it's a several billion dollar estimated tax increase on businesses for Oregon, you know, that's basically going to be there so that the public employee unions can continue to get COLAs when Social Security folks didn't, and they'll continue to, you know, pay for the PERS, you know, that grand bargain got thrown out by the courts, and it's just a disaster for Oregon's economy if it goes through. Both those taxes would be disastrous to Oregon's economy. We've already made Oregon one of the most uncompetitive states in attracting new businesses when we passed the sick leave and minimum wage laws. And to pass a gross receipts tax and a carbon tax would just make us hugely uncompetitive. Now,
I can't remember which tax it was, but they made it retroactive for 2 years.
Oh, gosh. That was the increase in the income tax, I think, in Measure 66 and 67.
Yeah, how can you make a brand new tax retroactive for, you know, a couple of years past?
I don't know. It was one of those things where you just scratch your head. I don't know how you make taxes retroactive. And then, you know, as the worst thing for businesses is to have uncertainty.
Right.
And every time they're talking about this sort of stuff, it makes it uncertain for a business to locate here in Oregon. So they'll choose to locate in a state that's not talking about these kind of tax increases. Just talking about them keeps people away from us. And, you know, and it's that uncertainty that will move businesses out. I think we're getting ready to lose a business from the Eugene area because the city of Eugene can't give them any certainty over whether they're going to be able to get their permits in time to build this summer. And it was in the newspaper a couple weeks ago, PackTech, which is a plastic, they make like the six-pack rings for beer and soda and stuff like that. Plus, they also make multiple different, you know, packages. Plastic packaging that hooks containers together, basically. And they do it with recycled plastic. 70%, I think, of their of their end product came from recycled, and they use a lot of local content too, which is really hard to get rid of plastic out of the waste stream. I can tell you that because Lane County manages solid waste, and I know how difficult it is for us to deal with plastic right now that China's stopped buying it. And you know, this is a great green company. They have high-paying family wage jobs with full benefits, and the city of Eugene was trying to force this company into an annexation, and has been for the last 9 months. And the company was finally agreeing to say, okay, we'll annex. Let us sign an agreement about that. Just issue our permits. And the city of Eugene basically told them, no, you got to annex first. Then we'll talk about permits. And, you know, that's a long process. And the company is looking elsewhere. From what I understand, they looked at several places outside of Lane County. I'm hoping we can get them enticed into some place that's just away from Eugene, but still in Lane County. But the company currently employs about 130 employees, and the expansion was going to add over 100.
Right.
You know, that is the kind of business. And this is the city of Eugene that's supposed to be, you know, got this manufacturing designation, manufacturing partnership designation from the federal government, went through all these hoops to get designated. And then they're chasing a green company that's a manufacturer out of the area. They're also the city that constantly talks about the food and beverage industry and how important that is to the area and how they want to develop local food and all that stuff. This company makes the six-pack rings for Oakshire, you know, and all these local and the packaging devices for a lot of local food companies. It's like, it's almost unbelievable to me how people can't get the fact that uncertainty holds businesses down and holds down investment. Yeah, there's a great book out about the Great Depression called The Forgotten Man by Amity Shales. I'll occasionally give a book review in here maybe or two, but if you want to read a book that will describe the Great Depression basically from start to finish and some of why it went on as long as it did, this is a really good book about it.
And correct my history, didn't one of the things that helped fix the depression was lowering the taxes on people, putting more money in the economy?
I am not sure if that's exactly the case. I think basically the depression ended when the war started and we had to ramp up production for the war. The reason it went on so long and is well documented in this book was Roosevelt was fickle, and he had multiple people on his economic team that went in and out of influence with him. Whether it was his Secretary of Agriculture or the guy that was running the CCC, these advisors of his would come into favor and out of favor with their pet economic policies, and he kept changing economic policies constantly or discussing changes in economic policies, and it froze the business community. You know, absolutely froze capital investment in the U.S., you know, other countries came out of the Great Depression much faster than the U.S. did. So, want to read a good book about that? The Forgotten Man by Amity Shales. And that's Shales. So, you know, we can always learn from history, but, you know, the greatest killer of business investment is uncertainty. The next greatest killer is taxes and regulation. Over taxation and over regulation. You know, you can have certainty, but if you raise those two things to a level where you've made your region, your state, or your country uncompetitive with other countries, even having a great workforce or quality of life will not draw a business or keep a business in your area that can prosper more greatly somewhere else and put up maybe with a little lower quality of life or a little bit more difficulty in finding qualified employees. But for, you know, not having a 9% income tax rate for having to grant sick leave and tracking sick leave for part-time employees and not having a minimum wage that's far above the rest of the country. Those sort of things will make the decision for a company to relocate. And
on top of that, I think that especially local governments are the $15 an hour people are forgetting that a business is not created to provide you a job. It is created to create a profit and to grow and expand. I mean, your wife's business wasn't created so you can give two people a job.
No. No, it wasn't. And that's something I think a lot of people forget. Speaking of Bernie Sanders, he was
good
in Springfield
in.
Today. He was in Springfield today.
In Springfield.
Yeah. Businesses are not set up to employ people, and they're not set up to fund the government. They are set up for the sole purpose of making a profit. And it's if you try and remove that, they will cease to function and cease to exist. Because there's no reason for somebody to go through the hassle of owning and running a business, which even in a small scale of one business with three employees besides her and myself, it's a lot of work. I mean, my wife is an 80-hour-a-week person, and I help her out when I can. That's what it takes to run a business. Why would you do that if you couldn't make money doing it? I'll never understand these people that think we're going to pay for all these free things for everybody by taxing big business, as they like to put it. I kind of wonder what big business is. Most of those big businesses have a tendency to be owned by many, 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 many people. So if you get down to what it is per owner of the business and the shareholder, per share, they're not really that big, compared to, what you think of what my wife's business, even as small as it is, we're the only two shareholders. So we may actually have a bigger share of our business than somebody that owns a share of Apple stock. This kind of, what is a big business? It's that shareholder that wants to make the money.
And how many times even in your small business that you had to pay the employees before you paid yourself, if you had anything to pay yourself?
It's been a few times. We ran into that a couple years ago where we literally did not pay ourselves. We didn't pay the rent to ourselves. We rent from ourselves the office space the corporation rents from us personally as one of those things you do financially. To make it a clean transaction to keep the business's books separate from your personal books. And also the IRS kind of likes it that way too. And we literally, there was a period where we underpaid ourselves severely. We foregoed paying ourselves rent for several months, but we never missed a paycheck to those three employees. You don't hear about that as often. With a business that the owners, but you see it even with the big business. How many times has there been no dividends declared from a business that's not doing well? And, what happened to the value of, let's say, somebody that owned a share of Chipotle when they had all their problems with E. coli and various other foodborne illnesses that dropped their quarterly profits to zero and actually had a huge loss in that quarter. It wasn't the employees at Chipotle that paid that. It was the folks that owned Chipotle.
Right.
And I'm sure that in the upper levels of the management structure, the bonuses for last year probably reflected that situation as well. So it's not the line employee that's making the food that got took the loss on that. They still got paid. They might have lost a few, got scheduled for less hours as the actual businesses weren't as busy. But the real people that lost are the owners, and that's something people forget about day to day, that there is an owner somewhere on that business. Even ExxonMobil, even Apple, even IBM and Microsoft, and you name the large corporation, they're made up of multiple owners of that corporation. And it's the owners that make the money or lose the money, not the employees.
And your unseen partner known as the government. Like, for example, when I had my business, I found out, and I did not know that Oregon had this, which I called or dubbed the TP tax, otherwise known as the personal property tax. You want to tell them what that is?
Yeah, last March, is it 15th that they're due?
I fill out,
the one thing I do for Elizabeth is I do some of the books. We do have a bookkeeper, but when it comes to things like filing the taxes and because the bookkeeper's on our payroll, I actually do the payroll every 2 weeks. It takes me about a half hour in QuickBooks to do that, pay the payroll taxes. But I fill out the personal property tax thing. And the one thing you're supposed to do is go through a list of all the office supplies you have in your office at the time and put a value on them as of January 1 of the year or December 31st. I can't remember what it is. Everything from toilet paper to copy paper to paper clips, all that stuff has got to get assigned a value.
Yep.
Along with every desk, chair, computer, copy machine, printer, and everything else you have in your office.
Locks, signs, everything.
Yep. And for a business like ours, it adds up to about $15,000 worth of personal property that we get taxed on annually. So it's not that big a deal for us. We're right on the verge of actually being exempt from filing. But this is what people don't get so much, is when you're a company like Hynix, when they were here, their personal property was worth billions. A single line to do a computer chip, manufacture a computer chip, can be worth $250 million. And when you line up, four or five of them next to each other to do a manufacturing process and be able to manufacture 24/7 and take lines down one at a time, that can be a couple billion dollars worth of taxable property. That's a incredible amount of tax. People don't realize how much business personal property tax gets paid to their local governments. It gets built into the price of everything that you buy here in Oregon, is that personal property tax. But yeah, the toilet paper tax is definitely there.
Yep, exactly. Hey, Jay, in the last 15 minutes, you had a lot of little town halls. Do you want to maybe comment on how those went and what people asked or talked about?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. We did finish our last town hall Monday night of this week out there in Blatchley at the Triangle Lake School. And we did them in Santa Clara, Veneta, Florence, and Mapleton also, the sheriff, Byron Trapp, and myself. And it's always interesting because you just never know who's going to show up, how many people are going to show up, and what they're going to ask about. And before we go too much further, I just want to remind people, if they want to talk about anything, and it doesn't have to be the town halls, they can call 646-721-9887 and press 1 to get in on the conversation. But the town halls are funny because every town hall covered a different subject. We started with the same basic information. I presented some information. We had our first audit come from our performance auditor on our financial indicators, and I talked about that a little bit. I talked a little bit about the jail levy and timber funds, and I also talked about the increase in traffic deaths and the decrease in patrol strength and how they match each other. The sheriff talked a whole lot about the jail levy, talked about returning the 24-hour patrol and some other issues with the sheriff's office. And then we turned it up for questions. And in each different location became, everyone always says this, all politics are local. Every area had its own local issue they wanted to talk about to some degree. When we were in Veneta, the first one, they wanted to talk about the Fernridge Community Policing District. Was there any chance it was coming back? You know, there were people there that were highly against it, and they were hoping we'd never bring it back again. There were supporters there hoping that it maybe could get some life breathed back into it. But a lot of the questions were about that, and a lot of questions about why it took us so long to get back to 24-hour patrol, which some people might not understand, but we actually started – we were able to reestablish funding for that through a state law that allows us to move road fund into patrol 2 years ago, but it took almost 21 months before we actually got back to 24-hour patrol, partly because we were maintaining our existing level of patrol on by having some of our officers work overtime just to maintain our anemic level of patrol, because we didn't have enough staff. And when we were trying to hire the staff, was also at the same time we were still hiring for the jail levy, so we're competing with ourselves for a very narrow labor pool. But it takes about 4 months from the first time you advertise to going through all the interviews and all that to where you actually swear a newbie deputy in. Then they go for 5 months of training at the state. And then they come back and they spend several months with a sworn, already on-duty officer working as their co-pilot in their car for about 4 or 5 months. And it's usually – and then, you know, of course, some of that gets interrupted by vacations and other issues. It's usually about 11 months from the day we hire a newbie – this is after the 4 months – till we actually put them in a patrol car by themselves. So you're basically talking, you know, over a year from advertising for people that want to be a deputy to actually putting them in a patrol car by themselves. And there's a fair amount of washout rate. And at the same time, we're still having retirements and folks leave the force. So it took us basically 21 months to staff up to a level where we could go to 24-hour patrol using some overtime. And we hope to actually stabilize and discontinue the use of overtime to keep the 24-hour here shortly with the next round of trainees that come through. But that was a big issue in the Veneta area, because they kind of, the announcement that we got back to 24-hour patrol just by pure coincidence happened after we decided not to put the policing district on the ballot. And there were the usual conspiracy theory folks were like that we did that on purpose. And it's like, no, we actually started trying to get back to 24-hour patrol 2 years ago. It just took this long to get there, and explaining that to folks and what it takes to hire a deputy. You know, it's kind of funny. There was one group of newbies we sent to the state for training, a group of nine, and before the 5 week training was over, eight of the nine had washed out of the program and were no longer working for Lane County. So you even have that issue too. There's attrition just going through the training. You know, it's funny to hear the sheriff talk about doing the hiring. They'll get hundreds of resumes in, but you know, only very few of them have, you know, meet the even minimum qualifications, which isn't much for a deputy. Basically, you have to have a high school degree and be a U.S. citizen, or be eligible to be a U.S. citizen within a year. So it's really, you know, very low bar, but you'd be amazed how many folks we get that don't and not have a criminal record. You know, is one of the issues there. So, you know, just in the initial screening, you know, we lose a good half of those folks. We might get 100 decent applicants. We'll invite them to come in for a very basic physical test, you know, where they have to do so many sit-ups and the pull-ups and run, you know, a mile under 15 minutes or something like that. I mean, it's really not a strenuous physical test. 50% of the people won't show up for the test, and only 50% of those that show up will pass the test. So you're like already down to 25% of that 100 applicant pool, which was already weeded out from the 1,000 or so people that sent in applications. You know, And then you get down to where you actually start doing background checks and stuff like that. You might end up with 5 to 10 people out of 100 that make it to the point where we might offer them a job, then they accept it, and we swear them in and start them into the training. So if you wonder why it's so hard to ramp, it's really difficult to ramp back up after you've made cuts in a program that requires that much training in the employee. Because you really don't want, you know, Joe Blow out there with a 9mm and a souped-up car going to situations that are pretty volatile and dangerous as part of the county. Because, you know, we've seen situations where there was a one reserve deputy, I think, in Kansas that shot somebody because he thought he was pulling his taser out and pulled his pistol instead. You know, and it was there was audio tape of it where he goes, "Oh my God, I shot him, or something like that. And he calls in for an ambulance. That's what happens when you have non-trained people out there. And you can imagine the lawsuits that come with that sort of thing. So it's worth having the training and all. But that was Vinita's big issue. Florence, there were some people from outside the Florence city limits that were concerned about the low-level patrol and the high-level property crime out there, but didn't seem willing to be pay any more because they thought they were paying enough, even though Lane County has the lowest local taxation of per capita of almost every county in Oregon. You know, it always amazes me. The disconnect between that. Mapleton, it was actually a very, very localized issue. There was a homeless person that had been basically terrorizing the little, I don't know if you're familiar with Mapleton, there's a little strip there of retail stores right at the corner of Highway 126 and Highway 36. And there was a homeless guy that was living in the area that was kind of terrorizing those group of businesses, their customers, and all, and they were looking to have that kind of resolved. We actually found out that he had been actually broke into one of the bar that's there in that group of businesses and stole some liquor, and had actually been convicted of that not too long ago. So I got to touch with parole and probation folks, and they're going to follow up because he is still on parole, apparently, and hopefully he'll be dealt with. But the guy's got mental issues. Severe mental issues or something driving some of his behaviors, and they were worried that eventually somebody was going to shoot him when they got scared, because most people down in Mapleton carry. And apparently this guy's 6'8", and can be really menacing at times. And that was the issue there. So, you know, you talk about all politics are local. Up in Triangle Lake, it was all about a park up at Horton Lake, which is near Triangle Lake, that's run by the Bureau of Land Management, where they're not patrolling it very well, and there's a lot of drinking and bad behaviors going on, and it's attracting a certain crowd in the summertime. And that was their issue there, was this park. And of course, still it's a public safety issue, but it's all local. And of course, Santa Clara, we had held that meeting shortly after the shootings at Emerald Park there in the River Road area. So a lot of the discussion was about that particular shooting and some of the plans to kind of beef up some prosecutions and patrol of Emerald Park on a temporary basis, but it's not something we can sustain under our current budget. So it's always interesting to get out in the community, but it's always interesting how almost always, even with a group of strangers, although with Mapleton, the business owners from that retail strip all came as a group to my meeting. So they came there with an agenda and steered the meeting to some extent. The other meetings, everybody came on their own as single people, but it diverted into these local issues, you know? So whenever you hear that saying that all politics is local, it does get down to that level just about getting out in town halls. It becomes what's on the minds of local people. And generally, once somebody brings it up, they're all like, yeah, what about that park? You know, And what about, you know, the fact that so-and-so's house got robbed while he was, you know, snowbirding in Arizona this winter, you know, which is the Florence issue, is a lot of those homes get left empty for months at a time. And the tweakers find out about one, and they'll pull a moving van up to it and clean them out, right down to the copper wires out of the walls if they can. So, you know, it's an issue, and it's something, you know, we're trying to deal with in our budget, maintain 24-hour patrol. But, you know, our 24-hour patrol means we have 3.5 deputies on average out there on in a county that stretches from the Pacific Ocean all the way up to the ski resorts in the Cascade Mountains and is 4,000 square miles, you know, not quite the size of the state of Connecticut, but getting a good portion of it. And we have 3.5 people covering that territory. It's pretty hard to really make a dent in property crime at that level of enforcement. And that's one of the reasons why in my town halls, I talk quite a bit about timber funding and the disinvestment of the federal government in our federal forests that has led Lane County to some of our crisis in most of Southwest Oregon. Back in the 70s, in today's dollars, we used to get about $115 million a year out of our federal forest. This coming year, we're projecting to get about $2 million. That's a big, big change in disinvestment over the years, and it's one of the reasons why we have such anemic prosecutions, such anemic patrols. We had to go out for a local option levy just to get enough local jail beds to be about 1/3 of the state average. And it's, you know, a difficult thing to fund public safety on this level of funding, but, you know, we do our best. And I will say one thing, Lane County's staff and our administrator have been extremely innovative in trying to save money. And our budget coming out this week, you'll hear more and more about that over the next couple of weeks. But they've done things, everything from self-insurance for our health insurance to the fact that we actually didn't spend the PERS savings from the grand bargain a couple of years ago. We put it into the reserve, smart Lane County, and we probably won't deal with the biggest issue when the PERS rates go up next year. That's helped us weather some of this federal government disinvestment. But, you know, it gets down to we either have to put our federal forest back to work for us or the federal government should own the damn federal forest. And, you know, or we have to decide, are we okay with this level of local service? You know, or is this all we're willing to pay for? Or is there more service we want? And if so, what do we want and how much are we willing to pay for it? On the local level, if we don't get the federal government to reestablish management of our federal forest. And I'd add the state government into that, too, because we're having to sue the state of Oregon to try and get them back to what they promised when we set up the forest trust lands with the state that were actually county-owned property that we gave the state to manage. So it's always interesting to get out in the public. I enjoy it. I enjoy interacting with the public. I wish folks will call into the show a little bit more because it's more interesting when I can have a conversation. Again, you can also email us at talk@krbnradio.net. And, you know, you can get a hold of me in multiple ways if you want to talk about county politics or you want to talk about anything. This show actually is to go beyond the county. We'll talk state. We'll talk national. But you can reach me by personal message on my Facebook page. You can reach me by email at the county and by phone. So I hope to hear from you out there if you can't get me at a town hall or if you're unable to call into the radio show. So that's going to be about a wrap for tonight's Bo's Nose show. I enjoy talking with everybody, and I hope you learn something every time you listen. And please call in next time, and we'll have a conversation. And I really want to thank you for listening. And, you know, it's another lovely evening here in downtown Elmira. And we'll catch you next week on the Bo's Nose Show. Thank you and good night.